Welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan Clow, your host, and thank you once again for joining us on The Sector, episode 12. We have a fantastic show today, lots to discuss, some interesting news items, and of course the big question of the week from last week's show. We also have an interview with Chris Brandt from Music Heals, a local organization which supports musical therapy. With Chris, we'll be discussing fundraising, running an organization, social media, the whole kit and caboodle. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be very fascinating and a lot of really good information there for those of us who are involved with nonprofits, including small ones that are operating with big ambitions. So speaking of big ambitions, there's been some interesting news items that have come out just recently with regards to charitable giving in America. Now, we all know that charitable giving in America is one of the biggest sectors that they have. The Yanks are actually quite a bit more generous than Canadians, and we've actually theorized on a couple of reasons, you know, why that might be. Maybe it's because Americans lack the same kind of social safety net that we here in Canada take for granted, and so we don't feel the same need to donate the way they do. Well, there's been a couple new studies that have just come out. And they provide some, well, interesting results about American giving habits. For instance, Americans are giving more to charity and less to the church. Now, the rise of charitable giving is most pronounced, if not only pronounced, among the wealthy. So two interesting points there. Now, the first one related to giving to charity but less to the church is a very interesting concept because, as we know, here in Canada and in most developed countries, charitable giving more often than not goes through a religious institution. Or, if not necessarily the institution, is done through religious messaging, if I can use that term. It's framed in the sense that it's religious. It may be that you raise money through your church group and that money gets invested to a certain charity, whatever that charity may be. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with that, but it does raise interesting questions, as we've talked about here on The Sector. Given the fact that many religious organizations are a far bit more conservative than many of the general public would normally accept from a nonprofit. When it comes to social justice issues like gay rights, women's rights, animal rights, well, any kind of rights, really, churches tend to, well, lag behind a little bit. They tend to be a bit more regressive, a bit more traditional. Now, the average donor here in Canada gives to many different charities, but I think that many of us, when we give to charity, we're taking a more liberal point of view. We're taking a more egalitarian point of view. We wouldn't really accept the idea of giving to a charity that openly opposes gay marriage. We wouldn't necessarily give to a charity that openly opposes the environment and climate change. And yet, you know, many religious organizations actually do hold those views. So it's an interesting dichotomy between what we consider a source for charitable donations, charitable gifts, and, you know, ultimately what that money ends up being used for. The report in question came from Giving USA Foundation. They found that in 2013, Americans gave approximately $335 billion to charity, which represented an increase of 3% when you adjust for inflation. Now, the percentage of giving to churches declined by 0.2%, or 1.6% when adjusted for inflation. Now, you might say, okay, well, 0.2 or 1.6, whatever, that's a very, very small number. It's a small percentage. Now, of course, the thing is, when you minus 1.6 or 0.2% from $335 billion, well, you get a pretty large number. In fact, that's one of the interesting aspects about this, is that we may look at this and go, oh, well, it's a really paltry amount. But given the fact that most people, the average American, the average Canadian, isn't personally giving $85 million or $16 million or $125 million to charity, we're giving small amounts like $25, $15, $50, $100, $250. So that's where the bulk of the money is coming from. That's the form that it's coming in. So if we're noticing a decrease in fairly large amounts of money, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even $1 billion, that means that a whole lot of people aren't giving $50 or $100 or $120. And of course, you do have the wealthy people out there, the billionaires, the trillionaires, who do give exorbitant amounts of money, both to Christian and non-Christian or religious and non-religious organizations. But consider now that a lot of people, middle-class people, aren't making those small donations to religious organizations like they used to. And as anyone knows, I mean, you can't always get by as an organization, as a nonprofit, as a charity, relying on the checks from, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Big. You also have to rely on Mr. and Mrs. Small. And those small donations, they add up over time, and they also morph into larger donations. They climb the donor pyramid, to reference back to a previous episode. So this is a really interesting statistic, and it's going to have a pretty big impact on the charitable landscape in America. Now, of course, there's another side to this whole argument, and I mentioned at the top of the segment that giving amongst the wealthy has gone up, whereas giving amongst the middle class is starting to go down. What's interesting is that when you take into account all the different charitable sectors, we are seeing increases. So, for example, 7.4% increase in education, 6.3% for the arts and humanities, and woohoo, arts and humanities, 4.5% for health organizations, and yet giving to religious groups declined by 1.6%, and giving to social services rose only by 0.7%. Now, social services, I mean, that's one of the things that here in Canada we have a lot of. Well, a lot by comparison to America. So it is a bit concerning to see that slow increase in social services, whereas we're seeing quite a large increase in terms of education or arts and humanities or health organizations. One of the conclusions made by this latest research suggests that as the recession slowly kind of fades away into memory, the affluent donors in America are sort of reshifting their priorities away from social services and refocusing them on, well, for lack of a better term, prestige donations. Gifts to their old universities, medical foundations, educational services. You know, if we want to be pessimistic about it, we could say that they are shifting back towards the things that gave them naming rights. You know, if you want a new library named after yourself, if you want a sports stadium, or you want your high school football team to be playing in the Mr. Big Arena instead of whatever, you know, that's sort of what we're seeing. And you can make that assumption based on the data. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is that as the affluent start funding the big projects, the big universities, the big hospital foundations, and those are, in fact, the sort of two biggest sectors for large gifts, education and health. Now, the flip side is, who is funding the social services, and to the other extent, who is funding the religious organizations? Well, it seems to be that that's falling more on the middle class. Now, there's probably a lot of socioeconomic reasons why that might be. Perhaps because the middle class uses those services more often. Perhaps because there are economic factors, which mean that the affluent feel a stronger connection to the Ivy League educational systems. They feel a stronger connection to the big prestigious hospitals compared to the middle class. that's getting into a bit of a, well, we don't really have time for that discussion right now. But for this point here, consider that as the middle class shoulders more of the burden for the social organizations, the religious organizations of their communities, they ultimately have less to give because obviously they're in the middle class. And, you know, they're not exactly getting on the gravy train that the affluent are in America right now. It's not like the recession has completely lifted from the middle class. They're still struggling in times in certain places. So we are naturally going to see a decline in the causes that they typically support. So ultimately, interesting food for thought. Well, let's take a quick commercial break here on The Sector. We'll return after this with our big question of the week, as well as our interview with Chris Brandt. Stay tuned. We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now, let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Master Dirty Red Scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Filthy bastard tummies! I hate them, I hate
them!
Okay,
well,
You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling. Keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
Hello, we are back on The Sector, discussing nonprofit social justice and activism with me, your host, Ethan Clow, here on CITR. Now, last week on the show, I proposed the big question of the week. Well, actually, I had two questions. I had our regular big question, then I had a bonus question. So we'll maybe take these in reverse order. But first of all, the big question, where I ask our listeners to think about, to weigh in on, and to consider an interesting question related to nonprofits or social justice. If you want to participate in the big question or learn more about it, visit us online, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, to view all our show notes. If you want to join the discussion online on Facebook, we are at facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at sectorpodcast, or follow me, Ethan Clow, at Ethan Clow. And of course, for those old-fashioned people, you can just email at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. So last week, I asked two questions. I asked first, what type of fundraising annoys you the most? Whether it's door-to-door or phone calls or those sort of pushy street canvassers. And then I asked you another question, and this was related to one of my personal hobbies, that is watching Game of Thrones and laughing maniacally when characters people love are mercilessly slaughtered on that show. What can I say? I have a dark streak. Anyway, I asked because George R. R. Martin, the author of Game of Thrones, or The Song of Ice and Fire for my nerd friends out there, is offering a big prize if you donate to his wolf shelter. Well, not his wolf shelter, but you get the point, his favorite wolf shelter. And I asked, you know, is offering prizes and perks does that take away from the charitable aspect of a donation? I mean, does that kind of, you know, cheapen it a little bit? And that's an open question. I mean, I don't expect to have a definitive answer. And I think that there's different points of view on this kind of question. I think that some people, it's just extra motivation. And as I mentioned at the top of the show with our first news segment, people need to be motivated to donate. We're seeing declines in charitable giving in certain areas. So offering a perk or two, I mean, what's the harm? There's no real bad downside to that, is there? Well, I guess the question also becomes, does it not, or could it possibly, I'm not saying it has to, but could it possibly cheapen the message of your organization? You know, if I'm running a foundation that's trying to raise money, say to buy toys for underprivileged children, while that is a serious topic, toys imply fun, and I think we'd be forgiven for having maybe a silly or fun fundraising campaign to help get those toys, you know? Maybe we encourage people to come dressed as their favorite action figures from when they were kids, Transformers or G.I. Joes or whatever. Now, that wouldn't really be appropriate for a more serious and a more life or death charity. We wouldn't expect, you know, people to dress up as Megatron and Optimus Prime and attend an Amnesty International convention. So, if we offer the tagline that prizes should only be offered for appropriate causes, perhaps then we have eliminated any potential harm. And then it's just, you know, innocent fun that makes donating even more appealing to everyone out there. Of course, there is another unfortunate side effect, and this is brought to us by our good friends at the Canadian Revenue Agency. We love them so much. Of course, if you give something for a donation, in some jurisdictions, legally, it stops being a donation, because donations are usually required to have no benefit to the person giving the money. The only benefit allowable is a tax receipt. What's interesting is that if you give a prize or a gift or any kind of kickback to reward a donation, you usually have to subtract the value of that prize from the gift receipt. Now, it's even more complicated than that because depending on the ratio or value associated with both the donation and the kickback will determine to what extent you have to devalue the tax receipt. Now, tax law is not interesting, so I'm not going to go into it in detail. Those rules are out there, and maybe that's something more for the blog to discuss. But just keep in mind that if you are donating to your favorite cause here in Canada, and they offer you a kickback or a gift that has a decent value attached to it, that could take away from your tax receipt. And if that's something that's important to you, well, you know, just keep that in mind. But now on to the main event, the big, big question. I asked you what type of fundraising annoys you the most. And hands down, number one, not even close for this one, the big thing that annoys you most is phone calls. Everybody hates getting a phone call that asks for a donation, it seems. It is the number one annoying thing about fundraising for all you people out there, those of you who contacted me to let me know. Well, actually, let's ask Chris about this when we have him on the show and see what he thinks, but I'll guess that it's going to be the phone. Now, why does that annoy people so much? That's an interesting question. I mean, I've been on many mailing lists for charities. I get emails. I even get direct mail occasionally, which I actually kind of like. I like the direct mail. That's where you get a little envelope, and it says, "Dear Ethan Clow," and it's handwritten, and you open it up, and it's just got this really nice, well-written appeal. "Thank you for your past gift, Mr. Clow. Here, we really need your help," blah, blah, blah. I find those one of the strongest appeals possible, but I'm kind of old school in that way. Emails are, yeah. I'm not crazy about emails. Now, full disclosure, I have actually been one of those people who calls you up and asks for money. Yes, I have done fundraising over the phone. And you might think, wow, Ethan must have hated that. But I didn't. Actually, I rather enjoyed it. You know, the funny thing is, with any kind of fundraising, and this is also applicable to sales, is that the pushier and more invasive you are with your ask, the more people tend to recoil from it. Whereas with fundraising, sometimes a strong ask isn't pushy. It's not demanding of your time. It's not begging. It's not pleading. It's not pestering. It's a powerful appeal, but it hits you on a level that doesn't feel like you're being confronted by a really aggressive used car salesman. And that's one of the things that with a good phone call, it can be just about exchanging information. It can be just about reconnecting with a donor and making a connection with them, because that's really what all fundraising is supposed to be about at its core. Connecting with a donor, making a personal appeal, letting them hear a voice, hear a human being on the other end of that phone, and hopefully they're motivated to give because they feel that appreciation, that personal connection is strong and present, and it's not invasive. Now, of course, you can get the invasive phone call asking for a donation, and we've all gotten those. And that often comes down to the fundraiser in question, or, I mean, their training or their environment and where they are. So, you know, personally, I'm torn because for me, I don't mind the phone donation fundraising thing as much. And I know that for 99% of our listeners, that is the most annoying thing. They couldn't possibly imagine a more irritating, frustrating thing. Personally, for me, Ethan Clow, the most annoying fundraising tactic is street canvassing. I don't know why. I'm not exactly sure why this irritates me to such a degree. Maybe it just pushes all of my buttons in some way. All that, the combination of being solicited while I'm walking down the street, while I'm thinking about where I'm going, what I'm doing, having my eyes on the prize, as Yoda would say. You know, and then all of a sudden somebody's there in your peripheral vision, they're flagging you down, sir, sir, come over here, sir, sir, sir. And, you know, when you're out there, you, psychologically speaking, it's hard to ignore somebody who is waving at you and calling to you and sometimes walks right up to you and sort of gets in your way. I find that way more frustrating. You know, with a phone call, it's really easy to end that disengagement. You just turn the phone off. You hang up. Whereas it's really hard to disengage from a person speaking to you face to face. And this is a cool experiment. Try this with your friends one time, if you don't mind maybe pissing them off. But do a little personal experiment. When your friends engage you in conversation, try to disengage with them. And, you know, don't do it rudely, but just try to do it politely. And you will see what I'm talking about. It is incredibly difficult and awkward to disengage with somebody in the middle of a conversation with them. You know, the next time your friend is telling you a cool story, and, you know, you probably want to listen to the story and all that, but do this little psychological experiment for your own amusement and just sort of try to weasel out of that conversation or get away from it. Your friend will think you're crazy and you will look crazy. And that's why I think it's so hard to get away from street canvassers, because we're, you know, suddenly aware that there are people like watching us and we don't want to look weird and crazy and just storm away from this person who's talking to us. So street canvassing. I don't like it. I do not support it, and I will not stand for it. Let's take a quick break here on The Sector. When we return, we'll be speaking with Chris Brandt of Music Heals, and we'll get his take on fundraising, social media, and a whole manner of things important for the nonprofit world. Stay tuned.
Here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
he was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
This is Julie Ferris from MOVE. You're listening to UBC Radio, CITR FM 101.999.
Joining us now on The Sector is Chris Brandt, the Executive Director of Music Heals. Welcome to the show, Chris. Let's start off with Music Heals. What kind of organization is this?
Thanks for having me on, Ethan. Music Heals is a Vancouver-based foundation that raises money and awareness for music therapy.
And how did you get involved with this organization?
A friend and I, Dave Barnett, were on the Music Therapy Ride, which is an annual motorcycle ride that goes from the River Rock up to Whistler, hosted by a bunch of friends of ours, raises money for music therapy every year. This year they're going into their 13th year. And Dave and I have been big supporters of it in different varieties and supporters of music therapy in other areas, but neither one of us ride a bike. So we were inspired to take what our friends were doing and create an organization that runs the other 364 days of the year and continues to promote music therapy, unite the different initiatives that are out there, and hopefully provide more support for the rest of the year.
And you mentioned uniting the different disciplines that are out there. Could you give us a bit of an idea of what that means?
Well, there's different people who are raising awareness and money for music therapy across the country. And anytime that you do an annual event, there's always the big buildup, a month or two of work, and the event happens and then it drops off. And then you're almost starting from scratch 10 months later. And that goes for any event. That could be a sporting event. That's anything. And we thought if we could take these things that were going during the year that were already happening and not to cannibalize them or take over them or anything, but simply to help promote and use them to kind of swing from one rung to the other and unite them, then we'll keep music therapy top of mind all year round. And hopefully that'll be a motivator, make it easier for each event, whether they're ours or managed by someone else, to help fundraise and make a difference.
Excellent. And so did you have a background in the nonprofit sector?
No, I used to be the president of the board of directors for Music BC, which is a nonprofit. But as the president of the board of an industry organization like that, you're really in there once a month for 2 or 3 hours. This is what the staff is doing. You green light a couple things, you look at the financials, and then you leave it. So no real background in terms of actually running it. And so there's a lot of creativity that's been going on the last year and a half for us.
And so what motivated you then to sort of step into the nonprofit sector the way that you have?
Really, it was the chance for Dave and I to build something. While he and I were having conversations, we'd get together about once a month and have all these great ideas. And he'd be like, do you have time? No. Do you have time? Okay, see you next month. And in the meantime, Dave went and founded the charity. He registered the name. He hired a graphic designer to come up with a logo, registered the trademark of Music Heals, built the website, got everything off the ground, got the lawyers to do everything. So we're an official foundation, and then came back to me and say, okay, I built it. Now who are we going to hire? And I said, you know what? Give me the ball. I'll do it. It's time for a change for me. I've been very lucky to work in the music industry for about 20 years in different capacities, and I've had a lot of fun with it. And meeting people who were doing some cool things in nonprofit inspired me that maybe it was time to give something back. And as much fun as I've had being backstage with rock stars for 20 years, it was time to do something that mattered.
Oh, excellent. So as someone who's in a position of leadership in a nonprofit, can you share your thoughts on what makes a good leader and ultimately, how should a leader guide their organization? Because there's different philosophies on, you know, how someone should lead a group and how that group should develop and grow over the years.
I don't know that there's any distinction between leading a nonprofit and leadership, period. I think the error comes in when people treat nonprofit different than other businesses. A good leader is a good leader. And that's not to say that I'm one, but one of the things that I've recognized is, number one, surround yourself with people who are strong where you are weak. To do that, you need to identify where you are weak. For me, accounting is an area that I would rather not work on. If I need to, I'll suffer through it. I'll make it work. But it's not my strength. I would rather have someone on my team who is a whiz with numbers, who can deal with the accounting, the receipting, the back-end management with Canada Revenue. That's just one area where I've identified a weakness. And for me to continue to work on something like that really works against the charity, because it's going to take me 5 or 10 times longer to manage that than someone who's an expert at it. So the organization as a whole benefits by having people who are strong in different areas. And there's no point in having business partners who have the same strengths as you. That's redundant. Always surround yourself with people who are strong where you're weak. And then furthermore, another thing is making sure that those people get credit. The whole idea of hogging credit doesn't make any sense. There's a quote I'd read once before, and I can't remember who to attribute it to, but it's amazing what people can achieve when they don't want the credit.
Interesting. So let's shift gears to sort of the fundraising aspect. For Music Heals, what sort of funding do you rely on?
Well, we're still a new organization. So we've been dealing a lot with foundations. We've been throwing our own events. We've been partnering and taking advantage of events like the Scotiabank Half Marathon and 5K, which is this weekend. Last year, we raised $10,000. This year, our goal is 20. We're already at 10 so far in the fundraising. So there's a lot of opportunities out there for charities, whether they're self-created events or, again, tacking on to something like that, where to me, it's silly not to take advantage of them. To get these people who want to support you, who don't know how, and a lot of people who want to support you don't have money. So what's the easiest way for people to give? It's often not money. So I've got a team of, I think, 36 people who are running for me this Sunday on the Music Heals team for the Scotiabank Half Marathon and 5K, who aren't donating money to us. They're going running. They're asking their friends for money. They're doing their own fundraising. Everyone's got a goal of somewhere between $500 and $1,000 to try and raise. And that creates an opportunity for those people to be able to support us. And that works really well.
And so what do you consider would be the best practices for, you know, creating that kind of environment where people want to take part and help out and fundraise as best they can?
I think you need to make noise. I'm not a music therapist. I'm a noisemaker. And I think that one of the things you need to do is have your organization be top of mind. I've done consulting for nonprofits, and one of the first questions I ask them is, well, how many people are serving the same sector as you are? And if there's 3 or 4 of them and they're all getting government funding, that's fantastic. You love to see that. But say the government cuts back a program. Which program are they going to cut back? The one that no one knows about. They're not going to cut back the one that people are aware of. So we don't get government funding, but that same idea of be top of mind, make sure you're creating conversation all the time so that when someone is creating an event and doesn't already have an affiliation with the SPCA or Arthritis Society or BC Cancer, we want to add a chairman or a charity element. Who should we bring in? Oh, we just heard about these guys. And there's an opportunity to take advantage of that, not take advantage in the negative way, but to be that one that gets the opportunity to benefit from it because you're top of mind.
Excellent. And in your experience, what have been some of the challenges for fundraising for Music Heals?
No one's heard of us is the short answer. And not no one. We've been very lucky. The press has been tremendously supportive. And I get phone calls from people across the country who say that they have heard of us. But to generalize, we're a new organization. And people have sort of a mindset of how much money they're going to give in a year. And we're up against charities that you've known for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. And that's the ones that have always been top of mind. Since you were a kid, you've heard of UNICEF. You've heard of Red Cross. You've heard of organizations like that. We're up against that. People who are inspired to give X amount of money, and they're going to give it to somewhere that they know. So we just want to get on people's radar. And we don't do that. That's not to try and go out and hump somebody's leg. The first conversation doesn't make any sense. Traditional marketing says it takes people 8 times to know that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend you, or that it has a riboflavin, or whatever the product is that you're trying to sell. So maybe we ask you for money in our 8th, 9th, or 10th conversation. Our beginning conversations or just to hope that you get involved, to get emotionally invested, to be inspired by what we're doing, or at the very least think that something we're doing is cool and worth watching.
You mentioned the challenge of sort of getting your name out there and getting known. A lot of organizations have approached things like social media with a bit of trepidation, because on the one hand, it can be great advertising. On the other hand, it can also lead to a lot of controversies. So what's been your policy with that?
The more social media, the better. I have conversations with other organizations who are beyond hesitant with social media, and they fear that they're going to infringe on confidentiality of the people they serve, that they're going to trivialize things. And I try to give them examples and show that you don't need to involve your clients in what you do. There's ways of creating conversation, and to not use it is silly. We're a young foundation. One of the first things that people look at when they want to be critical of a foundation, or people have got the savvy to ask for, is they want to know, what's your administration percentage? And then the second question is, what's your advertising cost per year? We don't spend any money on advertising. All of the word of mouth that we get out there is social media. It's free. To not use it, your only excuse is maybe you don't know how, but that should never be the barrier. Figure it out. And all of the conversation we have out there is social media. We have professional musicians, you know, celebrity artists that talk about us. They do it in social media. The easiest thing for them to do is send a tweet. And to not have a presence, to me, you're living in the Stone Ages, not using it.
And Chris, you mentioned sort of briefly there the administrative costs, that sort of thing. And I ask every person who fundraises when they come on the sector, what is your view on, quote, overhead?
I think it's the wrong question. I think that at the end of the year, of course, you're going to have administration costs, but I think there has to be a designation, and maybe not everyone has this opportunity, but I think there needs to be a designation between donated revenue and earned revenue. Last year, we were lucky. We were able to do an event where we generated enough revenue that covered our admin costs for the entire year. At the end of the year, of course, when you look at the total money in and total money out, our percentage of administration obviously wasn't zero, but we didn't take a dime off of donated money last year. Anyone who actually donated money, that money went 100% through to pay for programs. We've just closed two fundraising programs. One, we did a Facebook post last week. I need to do a press release this week. And another one that we haven't announced yet, where we had the one from last week was the Wolf Radio Station in Regina raised some money for a Battle of Bands contest that they were doing for 6 weeks, and had contacted us about making us the official charity of the event. And we promised them, we're not going to take a dime off of it. We will take zero administration off of your fundraising. And in fact, we added money. They sent us a check of what they raised. We topped the money up and to the nearest $1,000 and wrote a check to a music therapy program in Regina. So we don't take money off of donations. So I think that's an important distinction. If you're able to say that 100% of donor revenue goes through to your programs, I think that's a more impressive question.
Excellent. Great. That's fantastic. So one of the questions that I've been interested in asking you is about the difficulty for raising money for something that people, as you mentioned, don't know a lot about, music therapy. It's also an abstract concept. I mean, you can't go and like pick up music therapy. It's difficult to see unless you sort of know music therapy already. So how do you get across to the donor what this is and how it works and how their donation is going to go and help people?
If by abstract concept you mean a service, because I would say nursing isn't something you can go and pick up, and I would say that education isn't something you can go and pick up, so we're providing a service, and the difference between providing a service versus a physical thing is a challenge, because most people are motivated to donate something they can put their name on, a television or in our case a guitar or a piano or something, and most people don't want to pay for the hours of service. And that's certainly a challenge, because for us, that's what's actually needed, is the music therapists are doing this amazing work and they just need to be paid more hours in the day to hit a wider audience to do it, to be able to add more patient hours in the facility they're working in. In terms of something that they may not be aware of, there's definitely an education about music therapy that is part of our conversation. So our mandate is twofold: to raise money and awareness for music therapy, because there are people who have no idea what it is. And I've had conversations with people where they might say, oh, I've heard of pet therapy. It's like that, right? No, it's nothing like that. So there's definitely some conversation that we need to have with people to sometimes even tell them what music therapy is, and hopefully they're inspired by that.
So what advice would you give to other organizations that are in a similar position where they're trying to educate somebody on a service that's not necessarily something a donor can have their name on or get a sort of recognition in that form? How would you provide advice in that situation?
I would say two things. Number one, this question plus going back to the social media one, the risk of not talking is that no one knows you exist. So you have to create conversation. You have to be talking about what you're doing, and you have to be doing it in a medium that people are looking at. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you know, celebrity conversations, radio, television, and more the editorial side, not buying advertising, but creating something that's cool enough for the DJs and local radio stations to be able to say, hey, this weekend, this is going on. You should go check this out. So creating good stories. On the other side, I would say lower the barrier of entry. We don't talk about music therapy all the time. We might talk about the power of music. We might talk about, how music affects somebody in a way that everyone gets. Relating to a story with that, we're doing interviews with different musicians where we ask them, your kid comes up to you and says, educate me about music. What's the first record you play them? When you go for a run, what's on your playlist? Let's talk about music in a way that everybody gets. And that creates conversations about the power of music. We start to feel affected. We start to acknowledge it. Okay, yes, I have personal examples of how music got me through a breakup or lifted me up during a downtime or reminds me of, you know, an amazing summer where we played this song over and over. Those are key points that everybody gets. And then hopefully transitioning the conversation into, now, can you imagine if an actual music therapist was involved? And this is someone who has a university degree and that is using therapy on a very clinical level using music. And that's how we'll transition that. So lowering the barrier of entry so that it's not such a hard thing for people to understand on the first question.
Excellent. Great. One of the topics that we've been discussing on the show today is fundraising methods that can have a negative impression on a donor. So, for example, a pushy street canvasser or door-to-door or phone calls. So first question, is there a particular method of fundraising that you find personally kind of annoying or fun or frustrating? And second, what efforts do you make to ensure that donors are respected and their time is respected while fundraising?
Personally, I can't stand getting phone calls at dinner time.
Yep.
One, from lists, I've never put my name on a list ever. And clearly someone got it and it's been sold. And I've asked people to take off my name and they don't. And I get calls every year. There are causes that I have supported for, you know, there's one organization that I've supported for a decade. And I've told them, like, I'll fund you once a year. I promise you, I don't have a lot to give, but once a year, send me a donor pledge form. And they call me three or four times a year. It's like, you're really making me regret this. I believe in what you do. Put somewhere in your files that you can call me once a year and get a guaranteed yes. When you call me the third time of the year, you're making me rethink it. What was the second half of the question? What are things that we won't do? Or what were things that, or how has our donors respected?
Yes.
Well, we've decided to take a long-term approach for that, knowing that we are a new foundation and that people haven't heard of us. We're building relationships. So we're not in a position where we're canvassing people. I've never sent an email directly asking people for money. I'm writing my first letters now, almost 2 years into this project, sending it to foundations to solicit potential opportunities. So we've taken a very long-term approach of how much money do we need to get by for right now? Let's try and get that much from a few places and then widen the net and just get people involved. This is what we're doing. I hope you think this is cool. We don't ask for money every time we post on Facebook. If you look at our social media channels, one every 10 or 20 posts might be, hey, we're doing this. Here's a chance to send us some money. You can't ask people for money all the time. You can't sell. That's one of the rules of social media, is maybe one or two out of every 10 posts can you talk about your business. The other 8 times should be just something cool that your followers want or would find interest in.
Excellent. And so you guys are at the early stages then in terms of your fundraising efforts, but have you already started to notice any kind of interesting demographics about the people who are following you, who are interested in you, and who will hopefully one day become supporters and donors?
I think the people that are following us, a lot of them are that lean forward clientele. We're not getting the passive people right now. We're getting the people who are out on social media, who are listening to the radio, who are going to events that we happen to be at, the Catalano Festival, the Squamish Valley Music Festival, we were the featured charity of the Vancouver Craft Beer Festival. We were the featured beer. So the official charity, $1 from every bottle of the official beer, which was done in partnership with one of our ambassadors, Prevail from Swollen Members. They created Prev Ale, and we got $1 from every bottle. So the people that are coming to Music Heals are people who are out there and that are active. We don't buy TV advertising. We don't pay for magazine ads or newspaper ads. So we're not hitting those people who are laying back and waiting for something to be exposed to them. We're getting the lean forward clientele who are clicking through or at an event or seeing their friends talk about something or some musician talk about something and they're clicking through it.
Excellent. Well, one of the programs that I was looking on your website, and I was really impressed by this, and I was just really surprised that this idea hadn't come up sooner, but you guys have what's called an iPod pharmacy. So tell us about this idea.
The iPod pharmacy was really meant to two of the things I've already mentioned, to lower the barrier of entry and to make some noise. It's something that's really easy for people to get their head around. Giving someone an iPod in and of itself is not music therapy. Music therapy is only music therapy by definition when it's performed by an accredited music therapist. But it creates the conversation and it's something that people get. A lot of people have seen the video of the cute old guy in the States who was non-responsive in a senior center and sat in a corner all day, and a nurse put headphones on him and collected some music from back when this guy was in his 20s, and he lit up and he just started singing and he was talking about how much he loved Cab Calloway and all this old stuff. That was a nurse. That wasn't even a music therapist. So that's something that people get and they start to understand, okay, so if I give someone my old iPod and a music therapist helps that person, the patient, put some music on it that's applicable to them, it might get a scared kid through a night in the hospital. It might help someone going through a really painful burn treatment to be distracted. It might help someone who's got dementia to listen to songs from their past and re-engage them and get them back into the world and be able to sing where they may not have spoken. So it's really just a tool, and the media loves it. People get their head around it. They want to talk about it. I have schools that will call me and say, hey, the grade 4 students are collecting iPods for you. Great. We're not asking you for money. Give us your old iPod. You can be involved in Music Heals by getting that thing that's covered in dust in your drawer. We'll take it. We'll clean it off. I try not to judge people's musical tastes. Skull Candy gives us headphones. Scotiabank has given us money for iTunes gift cards. And we give them to the music therapists. They're property of the music therapists. If they give them away, so be it. If they reuse them in their programs, so be it. And that's just something that it's a tool for them. In and of itself, again, it's not music therapy, but it's a really easy thing for people to get. And one of the things that's helped with us is musicians who are going on tour across the country and they want to support Music Heals, but I can't ask them to give me a couple bucks from every ticket because they got to pay for gas. They got to eat. But they might collect iPods at shows. And that way they can help us and be ambassadors for us. That doesn't cost them anything.
Well, I mean, it's a fantastic idea because, as you say, everybody's got an old iPod or an old MP3 player in their drawer that's just collecting dust. A great low barrier way for anybody to contribute in a meaningful fashion.
Yes.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the organization a bit. What's a day in the life of Music Heals like?
Well, they all kind of run into one. They don't stop. Music Heals for me is probably about 80 hours a week, it seems. There's so much going on, us being a new organization and being such a small organization and one where we handpicked our board to be creative, engaging people that we can turn on a dime. We don't have extensive board approvals to do things. It's really nice that we have a small group of people who all share a brain, who are behind every idea, and it's full speed ahead. So whenever we think of something, we can implement it later that day if we want to. And having that ability to move versus conversations that I have with friends who are working for massive organizations that are just big giant ships that they can't even get it to change one degree, that's tough. I feel for them. We're able to be creative and rejig where we put our resources in one conversation. If we're like, no, this, we should be going this way. This is cool. Let's do this. And we can.
Excellent. And what about the sort of volunteer roles that you have at Music Heals? I take it that volunteers would play a very important role in your organization.
Volunteers always play an important role. They don't always play a massive role in terms of the amount of time and what's being put into things, at least not for us, not at this stage. So the things that volunteers do for us are super valuable to us. We have an intern whose job is just to run our blog. The Music Heals blog is a collection of entries from music therapists and people in related industries around the world. And that's allowed us to get onto a much bigger stage and engage people in that community worldwide. And that's run by one of our interns who's doing an incredible job with it. There's a lot of things that we're doing that we're still doing ourselves. And being a new organization, we're building everything from scratch, and the voice needs to be solidified before things can get passed over. So volunteers are helping us at our events. They're manning the booth for us. They're talking about music therapy. They are incredible and super valuable to us. But right now, they're not in the critical roles. They're not in the decision-making roles. So the man hours, we couldn't do it without them. And that's something that I definitely want to take advantage of more. But as an organization that's still creating its voice, each piece is still meticulously put together and isn't farmed out just yet.
All right. Well, we're winding down for our interview. So it's time for our favorite segment here on The Sector, and that is the pitch of the week. So this is where we ask our guests for their elevator pitch, their 30-second to a minute pitch for a cause of their choice. So, Chris, let's suppose you corner the billionaire in the room and you've got a bit of their time. What would you pitch and how?
I keep saying that I'm not in sales anymore. So the elevator pitch isn't meant to sell. The elevator pitch is meant to get the person to ask for more information. And for us, it might just be an example of music therapy. Here's one case where something happened, how music therapy was used to make a difference, and then check us out. I'm not going to ask you for money. Get emotionally invested in what we're doing. If 6 months from now you think what we're doing is cool, great. Let's find a way that we can create a partnership where I can add value back to you if you support us. And the example of music therapy I might give is there was a woman in Vancouver 2 years ago, 71 years old, had had a stroke, and it knocked out the left side of her brain, which is where speech is located. And a music therapist was working with her and knew that music is located all over the brain. There's a speech center, there's a math center, there's a business center. There is no music center in the brain. And worked with this woman, had a stroke, hadn't been able to speak since her stroke, figured, okay, 71 years old, you probably grew up with the Beatles. Let's try Let It Be. Really simple, repetitive song. By the third line, the woman was singing. So the music therapist's ability to find this woman and get her to be part of the world again after her stroke is just one example of how a music therapist might make a difference.
And that's a great example of building relationships and bringing in the donor to the organization, making them feel as passionate about it as you do.
Yeah, I often ask people, how can I help them? Which they don't expect. Well, you're the charity. Don't you need help? Yeah, but what can I do for you? We're going to do this. We're making a difference. People are getting invested. I'm really grateful for the support and the amount of people who have gotten behind what we're doing. But each new person that I work with, I'll take a check. That's wonderful. But that's never the way I approach the conversation. How can I give something back to you? Is it public acknowledgement? Is it awareness? Is it something to do with your donation? Something that draws attention to you? Helping to pair you with a program, helping to just help you learn more about what we're doing and again, get you emotionally invested. Is there something I can do for you that makes it worthwhile, that we're not looking at writing you a receipt for your one-time donation? We're looking at building a 10-year relationship where you're going to be part of what we're doing.
Great. Fantastic, Chris. Well, before we go, how will people learn more and get involved with Music Heals?
MusicHeals.ca is the website, and highly encourage people to look for Music Heals on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, because that's where a lot of the stories are happening every day. The website gets the big ones, but the social media channels are the ones where you can see what's happening at all times, just the different conversations going on, and hopefully people check it out. They think what we're doing is cool, or at the very least worth keeping an eye on. And after watching what we're doing for a while, maybe they want to get involved.
Great. Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us on The Sector, and best of luck with Music Heals.
Perfect. Thanks, Ethan.
Shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
Well, we have reached the end of another episode of The Sector here on CITR. My thanks to everyone who tuned in. Obviously, we don't have a big question of the week for today's episode, but don't worry, we'll have one for next week. My thanks to Chris Brandt for joining us. And if you want to learn more about Music Heals, check out our show notes over at thesectorpodcast.wordpress.com. This is your host, Ethan Clough, saying thanks for listening and see you next week. Okay.
Up on the roof.